Good morning. Thank you for giving me this chance to come here and talk to you about what happened to Keith during his direct appeal. Appellate counsel admittedly used the wrong standard in deciding whether or not to raise on direct appeal the issue that the trial court had failed to give the jurors instructions on voluntary and first-degree involuntary manslaughter during Keith's trial. And she admitted using the wrong standard at the evidentiary hearing that we held in the underlying case. This court has been very clear since about 1999 in State versus Heidemann that when it comes to nested lesser includeds, the jury gets them. That's because jurors are free to believe some, none, or all of the evidence. And this court has consistently used that standard since 1999. Even in cases where
it says... since 1999, before Jackson, all courts were automatically given all lesser included offenses that were nested.
Yes, Judge. When it comes to nested lessers, I could only find a couple of exceptions. State versus Hibbler, from this court in 1999, but I think it was decided before Heinemann in 1999. State versus Beeler from 2000, which had that issue of imperfect self-defense, so it's not exactly comparable. And State versus Dorenzi, which is very interesting because although it says it's a reasonable juror case, if you actually read the opinion, it says jurors are free to believe some, none, or all of the evidence, which is exactly the language this court has been using consistently since 1999 in State versus Heinemann.
Hasn't there been more of a reasonable juror standard?
The lower appellate courts have been using the reasonable juror standard, even for nested lessers, incorrectly. And this court, in several decisions, Pond, State versus Williams, State versus Jackson, most famously, has been saying, no, 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 you're using the wrong standard. State, we're not going to use that standard.
Well, until Jackson, nobody said you can't use reasonable juror, and there's a long history of using reasonable juror. But absolutely a lot of cases said you can disbelieve all the evidence. Are those inconsistent? That's what your argument is.
There is a long standard of reasonable juror, but not in this court.
This court, going back 100 years, read the dissent.
Well, consistently since 99, this court has used the juror. The way I'm reading the reasonable juror standard, it's not consistent, as this court pointed out in State versus Jackson, with the rule that jurors are free to believe some, none, or all of the evidence. So, in other words, the lower courts have been sticking with the reasonable juror standard, even though this court has been saying, when it comes to nested lessers, jurors are free to believe some, none, or all of the evidence.
And you're saying that first happened in Heinemann, and from that point on, people should have realized that that meant the reasonable juror standard should no longer be followed because it was inconsistent.
With nested lessers, yes. As this court pointed out in State versus Jackson, if you use the reasonable juror standard, it turns the trial judge essentially into a 13th juror, as I pointed out in the reply brief. And as this court pointed out in State versus Jackson, that's not the judge's job, at a jury trial. Our statutes and our court rules say the judge decides questions of evidence, the judge decides questions of law, the jury decides questions of fact, or questions of fact as applied to the instructions it's given. So when you allow the judge to pick and choose which nested lessers go to the jurors, then you're essentially turning the judge into a juror. And that erodes the defendant's right to a jury trial. I mean, why not just have a bench trial and not use any jury instructions at all if you're going to let the judge have that much discretion?
We don't need to re-argue that here. We don't need to re-argue that question here. The court resolved that in Jackson.
Yes. Yes, it certainly did.
Did it resolve it before Jackson?
Yes, I'm saying it's very clear before Jackson.
Wasn't Williams clear?
Excuse me?
Williams' case clear in between Pond and Jackson?
Yes, because Williams also involved nested lessers. And that case is way more recent, from 2010. And so So the question is, what should appellate counsel have known? And appellate counsel just looked at the wrong cases. Even the cases that the respondent cites in its brief for why appellate counsel should have used the reasonable juror standard come from lower appellate courts. They don't come from this court. And it's a sad fact that, you know, the Court of Appeals have been ignoring this court's standard when it comes to nested lessers.
But are you saying that counsel was ineffective for not realizing that a whole slew of Court of Appeals cases were inconsistent with an earlier Supreme Court case and anticipating Jackson? That's a pretty tough standard to impose, isn't it?
Not really. I mean, which is the higher court, this court or the lower courts of appeals?
So where the Court of Appeals judge is ineffective? I mean, that we don't normally, I mean, not that you're not right by saying that maybe they should have, but is that ineffective not to see more than the Court of Appeals judge just saw?
Well, you have to, because you have to analyze whether you're going to win on appeal, whether you have a reasonable chance of winning on appeal. So in order to go through that analysis, don't you have to decide which is the correct standard?
But couldn't an attorney reasonably have said, these Court of Appeals decisions have never been taken by the Supreme Court has left them alone? Couldn't that have created some confusion as to what the appropriate standard was in an attorney's mind because these decisions were left alone by the Supreme Court?
Would you want to have that kind of appellate counsel for your direct appeal?
That's not the question.
I would not.
Yeah, but isn't it reasonable to see maybe there's a little bit of a state of flux or confusion in the law?
No. Since 1999, I counted at least 5 cases before Jackson where this court has ruled that nested lessers go to the jury. This court could not have been more clear. Nested lessers go to the jury. And unfortunately, you know, appellate counsel admitted during the evidentiary hearing, yes, I know that's the standard, the one that nested lessers go to the jury. Yes, I know that State versus Jackson did not enunciate new law, but despite that testimony, she still chose the wrong standard. Because she was looking for, well, is there evidence in the record to support the giving of the instruction? That's the reasonable juror standard. And she admitted that she was using an outdated standard during her testimony. So it isn't a question of was appellate counsel ineffective in picking the wrong standard? She knew what the correct standard was, and she didn't follow it. I think that's a more serious issue.
How is prejudice demonstrated in this case?
Excuse me?
How is prejudice demonstrated in this case by failure to give the instruction?
With appellate counsel ineffectiveness, the question is, is there a reasonable probability that the result of the direct appeal would have been different? And when it regards the nested lesser of involuntary manslaughter, yes, it would have been under this court's decision in State versus Jackson and State versus Williams and State versus Pond and State versus Dorenzi and all the way back to Heineman in 1999.
Well, they say it's automatically prejudicial, or what is how do they address it?
Well, I'm sorry, could you ask that question again?
Under those cases, it's prejudicial. Why? Because it's always prejudicial if you don't submit one, or what was the showing required?
In all those cases, which are all direct appeal cases, mm-hmm. the case was remanded for a new trial.
Where we're not on a direct appeal case?
No.
So in ineffective assistance, if you have to actually show prejudice, do you have to, or should we assume it? And if you have to, then you can't just say direct appeal case is automatic. Jackson certainly said it's automatically prejudicial on direct appeal and said
yes.
Now we're in a post-conviction Strickland context. What standard do we apply, and how do you meet it?
I think it's the regular appellate counsel ineffectiveness standard from Moss versus State.
What you're saying is, if it had been raised on direct appeal, the direct appeal standard would have required a reversal.
Yes,
so
Your Honor.
So it meets the requirement that the result of the direct appeal would
yes.
be different.
Yes, Judge Breckenridge, you are entirely correct.
In other words, prejudice goes to how the appeal would have ended, not how the underlying trial would have ended.
Yes. I would agree with that, with the caveat that under this court's decision in State versus Jackson, reversal is, I don't want to use the word guaranteed, this is the wrong business, but I would anticipate a favorable direct appeal result.
But it would have gone to the Eastern District first, and there were, even though they may not have been properly following Williams and Pond and all those cases, Eastern District had a number of cases that used the incorrect standard that we now know. So does that affect the prejudice? And then that would assume that this court then would take that to correct what the Eastern District did.
That may have to happen. I hope not. I think this court was extremely clear in State versus Jackson.
Agreed, but now, but we have to look at it at the time. Right?
Yes. I know that appellant's brief was written before State versus Jackson was decided. I cannot recall if the appellate decision came down before State versus Jackson was decided.
Okay.
I would have to check the timing.
Okay.
It was pretty close. That's why I make that caveat.
It was later that month.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you. Thank you, Judge Russell. So it's not just a question here of, you know, did appellate counsel use the wrong standard? She admitted she used the wrong standard. She admitted that State versus Jackson was only this court's most recent ruling on nested lesser offenses, and she still disregarded her own knowledge and decided not to raise this issue on direct appeal. And that should not have happened. That was ineffectiveness. And the prejudice that we have here is Keith gets a new direct appeal with an attorney who will hopefully use the direct standard, the correct standard. And that's what should have happened back down at the lower court level, because I think it all boils down to, and I may have to talk about this more in rebuttal, is do you trust jurors or don't you? Do you trust that they will listen to the evidence? Do you trust that they will read the instructions that you give them? Do you trust that they will carefully decide the case and applying those facts to the law that they're given? If you do, then you want jurors to have as much evidence as possible. And I think I will need to talk about that further on rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. 5 years ago, approximately, an appellate attorney working for Mr. Miner sat down, looked at the record in this case, reviewed it, looked at the state of the law, and concluded, in her view, that the evidence was not sufficient to support the submission of voluntary manslaughter or involuntary manslaughter, and thus that the trial court had not erred in refusing those instructions to the extent that she believed that she would prevail on direct appeal. Since that time, the legal landscape has changed dramatically, and despite what has been argued today by the appellant, the law was not clear, nor did this court's precedents clearly establish what the court held in Jackson. And most specifically, I would point to the language in Jackson where this court said that it was finally overruling that portion of Olson, one of this court's earlier decisions, which had expressly stated that the ability of the jury to disbelieve the evidence was not in itself a sufficient basis to acquit of the greater offense. That was an important development in the law and a change in the law that required this court to completely overrule its prior holding in Olson. And the court expressly stated and went through the history. There's been a lot of ink spilled, a lot of analysis over the years on the question of when the trial court is obligated to instruct down to an included offense, because there's a two-part test. One, that there be a basis to acquit of the greater offense, and two, that there be a basis to convict of the lesser offense. And the basis to acquit was the issue that finally came to a head in Jackson, where this court said that the basis can be the jury's ability to disbelieve that evidence. That was something
what,
that
what was different in Jackson? What did Jackson say better or more or different than Williams said, in your view?
A couple of things. Well, and Williams, I think, was the first strong indicator from the court that the ability to disbelieve would in itself be a basis to acquit of a greater offense. But it said a couple of things very clearly. One, it said, I think, in fact, it might be the first of this court's opinions that talked about nested offenses. I don't think the court had previously identified nested offenses. And the other thing that it did is that it expressly overruled Olson rather than saying, as the previous cases had said, we overrule Olson to the extent that they require the defendant to present affirmative evidence. Now, because you know, the argument that the state had advanced a couple of times and been rejected by this court was that the defendant had failed to present affirmative evidence that would support the submission of the lesser offense. This court expressly rejected that in Williams. It also rejected it in Pond, and it had earlier rejected it, I think, if I'm not mistaken, in Santillan. Now, but it did not reject that aspect of Olson that said that the ability to disbelieve is not enough. And so it was only to the extent that the defendant was required to present that affirmative evidence that Olson was overruled and other cases that had relied on Olson for that proposition. The court, even after it overruled Olson to that limited extent, in the Hibbler case, which was decided the same year as the Heineman case, in Dorenzi in 2002, in Pond in 2004, in Thomas in 2005, these are cases that are discussed in the history, employed a test that there had to be, quote, some evidence to acquit of a greater offense. Didn't have to come from the defendant. There just had to be some evidence, either direct evidence or an inference that would support an acquittal of the greater offense. The court repeatedly stated that over the years in those cases. It wasn't until we got down the line, but even in Williams, you know, while the court, I think, sent a message that might be where the law would go. In fact, maybe that was the court's intent. But it wasn't until Olson was fully overruled, I think, that became the rule. That you start seeing this notion that the jury's ability to disbelieve the evidence would be a basis. Now, let me backtrack just a small step. I think it has long been recognized by the court over and over again in many contexts that the jury always has the ability to disbelieve any part of the evidence. What made the difference in Jackson, though, is the legal effect of the jury's ability and how that interplayed with the statute for instructing down. Because under Olson, while the court recognized, I think the court has always recognized, that the jury could disbelieve the evidence, that's fine. But did that satisfy the first prong for instructing down? In Olson, the court said, no, it didn't. So the legal effect of the jury's ability to disbelieve was not held to be sufficient to require the trial court to instruct down to find a basis to acquit until Jackson, where the court said, Olson is overruled, we now overrule that part of Olson, and so the legal effect of the jury's ability to disbelieve, which I think has been recognized in many, many contexts, now stands for the proposition that provides a basis in itself to instruct down or to acquit of the greater offense. And that was a significant change in Missouri law. And up until that point, the Court of Appeals, not incorrectly, but correctly, had continued to say that if the only basis is the jury's ability to disbelieve the evidence, you don't submit. So if you look at, in fact, right after Williams was decided, the Western District handed down the decision in Lowe, and they applied a reasonable juror, rational juror standard. Because they went with the same test that the court had repeatedly stated, and it wasn't expressly overruled in its entirety until Jackson, which said that there had to be some evidence, some basis in the evidence, either direct evidence or by inference, to support the acquittal of the greater offense. So in Lowe, which was decided in 2010, after the decision in Williams came down, and Williams is cited and discussed in Lowe, the Western District still held in that case that the defendant had been found guilty of voluntary manslaughter had not been entitled to an instruction on involuntary manslaughter.
So your opponent argues that the Court of Appeals had been applying consistently this reasonable juror standard, although decisions from this court have never used that language in recent years, and so therefore the Court of Appeals decisions, the appellate attorney should not have followed them. They should have followed the decisions from this court.
I don't think this court abandoned the reasonable juror standard. I think what this court ultimately did, I think ultimately in Jackson it said we're not going to look at what a reasonable juror would do. But up until that point, the court had consistently said, with one minor caveat, but it had consistently said there has to be, quote, some evidence in the record, that some evidence that a reasonable juror would look at. And I think that's what Court of Appeals in Lowe said was that we've never abandoned this reasonable juror standard. There has to be some reasonable basis in the evidence.
Well, I mean, Lowell is a Court of Appeals decision, though, too.
That's true. But I think that the court was not incorrect when it stated that a reasonable juror standard had been employed by this court and had been employed by Missouri courts for decades, century maybe. I don't know. Maybe not centuries, but maybe over a century. And so it was a very significant change in the law in Jackson when the court said, we do so now, referring to the final overruling of Olson, and in particular that part which said the jury's inability to disbelieve the evidence is not in itself a basis to acquit of the greater offense. And in 2012, in the same year that appellate counsel in this case would have been making a decision which claims to raise, the Eastern District in Kaufman also found that there was no evidence of recklessness in a murder in the second degree case where the victim had been shot in the head. And so what you have is an attorney who's confronted with a series of decisions, almost all of which, with one exception, and I'll mention that here, say that there has to be some evidence and no overruling, no express overruling of Olson, which says that the jury's ability to disbelieve is not enough, and that standard still being employed by Missouri courts. You have an attorney who says, am I going to win on this? I don't think so. Now, the one case I've mentioned...
I would just mention that State v. Williams said only when a reasonable juror could draw inferences from the evidence presented that an essential element of the greater offense has not been established do you have to instruct down, and that was this court in 2010.
In 2010, that's correct.
Was that 2010?
But didn't counsel acknowledge that the refused instruction was a potential issue on appeal?
She did. She testified that she reviewed the record, she reviewed the motion for new trial with an eye toward identifying errors, and she identified both instructions as potential errors, but ultimately concluded that she didn't believe the evidence supported either one, and thus she didn't believe that she could successfully assert that the trial court had committed reversible error. Now, I also don't think that she said that she applied the wrong standard. I think what she said was, my recollection is that in light of Jackson, she now thinks that a court would say those instructions should have been given. Now, I disagree as to voluntary manslaughter, but I think that she's right as to involuntary manslaughter, and more particularly in light of Jackson and this court's subsequent decisions in 2015, Roberts and Randall, that had the involuntary manslaughter instruction been requested, it absolutely should have been given under this court's precedents in 2014 and 2015.
Can you address the prejudice question? And if, as Jackson said, it's automatically reversible error not to give the nested because the jury was deprived of the opportunity to consider the lesser, is that the prejudice necessary then if you're alleging appellate counsel was ineffective, not trial counsel?
Right. And I think that the test is slightly different from a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel, but here they tend to overlap because the claim is that, well, I guess they don't really overlap. Let me be a little more clear. The claim here is that appellate counsel should have asserted something on direct appeal that would have affected the outcome of the direct appeal. In other words, it would have resulted in a reversal for a new trial. And so the question is, in my mind, would the claim that direct appeal allegedly should have raised have required reversal on direct appeal, or is there a reasonable probability?
And do we have to assume that Court of Appeals would have gotten it wrong in order to defeat that argument? And can we do that?
No. I think when it comes to prejudice, you assume that the court conscientiously follows the law and applies the standards that would or should govern its decision. I don't think that necessarily is true with regard to counsel's evaluation.
Right.
Counsel might misjudge the law and might get it wrong because this court might go this way or might go that way. And if counsel misjudges it, that shouldn't necessarily mean the counsel was ineffective because there's a broad range of what we expect of attorneys, and sometimes they make mistakes. I represent the state. I'm held to a certain standard. I should be. I make mistakes. I stand before you. I do my best to say what I think the law is. But I certainly have made mistakes in the past, and hopefully that wouldn't be a grounds for saying that I was ineffective. But returning to the point of prejudice, I think in this instance, prejudice would then look to whether the claim would have required reversal. And this court's decisions have often said that prejudice is presumed when there's an instructional error and when you fail to give a proper instruction. And so if the claim were asserted, and if the standards were applied, proper standards, there would be a presumption of prejudice in this case from the failure to give that instruction. This court's recent decisions in four cases dealing with this, including Jensen, which is cited in my brief, suggest that or held that in some cases that presumption of prejudice could be rebutted, depending on the facts and circumstances of the case. From my point of view, the court should look at the manner in which the jury was instructed.
We haven't held that in nested cases since Jackson, though.
Pardon me?
We haven't held that in nested cases since Jackson.
Jensen did. It just said that the state didn't rebut the presumption of majority opinion. Correct?
That's correct.
The dissent and the majority, I think, applied the same standard, just come up with a different result on the prejudice analysis.
That's my reading of the case, Your Honor, is that the court indicated in those, there were four cases decided on the same day, Jensen, Sanders, and there are a couple more. I argued them. I should remember them, but I can't at this very moment. But my reading of those cases is that the presumption of prejudice can be rebutted in any case where a lesser-included offense instruction has not been given, but the state failed to do so as to any of the counts in those cases. Now,
counsel, if the motion court erred, if we reject your argument and the motion court erred here, what's the relief? A new direct appeal, and what's the purpose behind that?
Yeah, I mean, ordinarily when trial counsel's ineffective, you go back for a new trial. When appellate counsel's ineffective, theoretically you would go back for a new direct appeal. However, inasmuch as the court would effectively be deciding, I think, the direct appeal issue, if it were to grant relief, I'm not sure whether it would be appropriate to go through that. Frankly, I hadn't actually thought through that possibility, Your Honor, and what should the remedy, but how the remedy should be carried out.
That's confidence. We call that the. Wouldn't that be true in any ineffective assistance of appellate counsel case, though?
Seemingly,
you would have to decide how the appeal would come out.
Seemingly, if the court were going to grant relief, you would need to go through the direct appeal analysis. And but I suppose on the other hand, I've sometimes seen this court not decide issues that come to it in that regard and leave it to the lower court to resolve it in the first instance. I think that it would be up to this court and certainly within this court's discretion.
Well, we'd have to leave it to the appellate court here.
That's right. And
I'm not sure we've done that.
No, and like I say, I see my time is up, but I think it would be within the court's discretion to craft an appropriate remedy. And if it included going back through a direct appeal, so be it. But if the court were to decide the direct appeal issue and feel confident in its ability to do that, which I'm sure it is.
So we send it back to the appellate court under a presumption of prejudice and let them determine there whether the prejudice has been rebutted?
Well, you know,
if the remedy for ineffective assistance on direct appeal is that you get another direct appeal, then depending upon the case, it would determine where jurisdiction lied for the direct appeal.
That's correct. And if that is the nature of the remedy, I could conceive of a situation, though, where the court would say that that it would be a fruitless endeavor to require the appellate court, the lower appellate court, to go through the motions.
A futile endeavor. Yeah.
If this court had already decided the issues in such a way as to dictate the outcome.
Could I ask one additional
Certainly,
question?
Certainly, Your Honor.
You argue that the law wasn't clear on the requirement to instruct down until Jackson and Pierce. Is it really that Williams wasn't clear, or that it was enough of a change that there was resistance to accepting the clear language of Williams?
I would say that it was not clear. And I guess my reason for that is, and I think that I find backing for that in the fact that Jackson was the first case that finally overruled Olson, which was this court's pronouncement stating that.
I mean, the language in Wilson is Olson was overruled.
Yes, except that the court had when it referred to the earlier cases that purported to overrule Olson, those cases had said to the extent that it requires the defendant to present affirmative evidence. And so it was a limited overruling, and which the court acknowledged later in Jackson and said we now overrule it. And the other thing about Williams, which I think is important, is that the court also outlined an affirmative basis in the evidence to acquit of a greater offense. So there was evidence in the Williams case to that would have required a submission under the standard as it had been that there be some evidence.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me start with this question of remedy. Should we send it back to the motion court to decide how the appeal would have come out? Should we say how the appeal would have come out and remand it for a new trial if we think the appeal would have done so? What's this court's role?
Well, first of all, this court's role is whatever role it chooses to give itself.
Is there any precedent for what the correct remedy is?
A new direct appeal. And it, maybe I'm an optimist, but you know, my argument would be give the Eastern District a chance to get it right this time on remand. But, you know.
Well, wait a minute. This is a PCR case. We remand it. It goes to the motion court. To get a direct appeal, there has to be an out-of-time notice of appeal filed. You can't get to a direct criminal appeal out of this proceeding, it doesn't seem to me.
Thank you, Your Honor. You are correct. Yeah.
So how do we get to that? But is there a point, if we have to find, as I understand it, that it would have made a difference to the appeal, then is there any, what we were just discussing with opposing counsel, is there any point in sending it to the Court of Appeals? We've already decided the appeal would have come out differently.
You could if you wished. I don't see why
not.
Is there
some room for them to find differently after, or is our standard for deciding whether there was prejudice, does it necessarily basically direct their result?
Well, let me see. If Keith wins on direct appeal, then it would be remanded for a new trial, not before the motion court, but before a trial court.
Would the appellate court be free to not give him relief and find it wouldn't have made a difference if we found appellate counsel was ineffective because aren't we then finding that it would have made a difference? You see that?
I hate to say I'm not sure.
Yeah. Neither am I. That was my question.
It's just traditionally counsel.
What would the option for the motion court to be if the motion court had found appellate counsel was constitutionally ineffective and that the movement was prejudiced? What are the options for the motion court?
The motion court would have vacated the convictions and the sentence and ordered a new trial. Yeah.
If the appellate counsel was ineffective?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Why would you get a new trial if appellate? As opposed to a new appeal.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But you can't always raise ineffectiveness of appellate counsel in the motion court. I'm confident there's precedent. So.
No, I mean, the traditional remedy for appellate counsel ineffectiveness is a direct appeal. And I suppose what's blocking me right now is I'm not sure this is not a traditional. Mm-hmm. This is because of this court's line of cases. It's sort of a foregone conclusion what would happen before the direct appeal.
Did the trial court make a finding with respect to prejudice did the trial court just find that the appellate lawyer wasn't ineffective?
I'm trying to remember. You mean the motion court in
yes,
its findings? Sorry, Judge Powell.
Trial court.
I think the they made a finding that appellate counsel was not ineffective because it followed the Eastern District's line of cases.
And but if there was no finding of whether or not there was prejudice, then should it come back to the motion court to determine that outstanding issue?
Hmm.
worth thinking.
Why? I'm not sure what would keep the Court of Appeals from deciding if there's prejudice.
Based on the record.
Yes. I have 1 minute left. I'll be really quick. When we expect the jurors to do their job as jurors, we need to give them as many tools as we possibly can to do their job. And that means we need to give them as many instructions as we can so they can do their job the best that they can do it. If we deprive them of the tools to do their job, we're going to be getting lousy verdicts out of them. And that's what should not have happened in Keith's case. The jury had a choice between murder one and murder two. They picked murder two. If they'd have gotten other instructions, I think they would have gone lower. And the jury should have gotten the tools to do their job.
Thank you, Counselor. This is a well-argued case.